A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Ilana Gritsiewski sat across from Reem Al-Salem yesterday and described waking up in Gaza. Captured by Hamas on October 7th, she blacked out. When she came to, she was half naked, with no memory of what had been done to her body. She looked the UN Special Rapporteur on violence against women in the eye and asked for acknowledgement. And Al-Salem just stared back. The video shows micro-expressions that read less like sympathy and more like she was waiting for the inconvenience to end.
This is the person the United Nations appointed to be the global voice for women subjected to violence. In 2020, the Human Rights Council selected Reem Al-Salem for that mandate. And yesterday, a former hostage described waking up violated and disoriented, and the rapporteur's response was essentially nothing. Not even the performative nod you'd expect from someone whose entire job is signaling concern.
Which brings us to Daniel's prompt. He sent us this one after watching that footage. His question is essentially, why? Why does the UN consistently appoint special rapporteurs who come into these roles with obvious pre-existing bias? Bias they increasingly don't bother to hide. He points to Al-Salem and to Francesca Albanese, the special rapporteur on the occupied Palestinian territories, as Exhibit A and Exhibit B of a pattern. In any well-run organization, conflicts of interest are disqualifying. Judges recuse themselves. Ethics rules exist. So what's broken here?
The question underneath Daniel's question is whether this is about two bad hires, or whether the hiring machine itself is designed to produce exactly this outcome.
Because if you look at the timeline, Al-Salem appointed in 2020, Albanese in 2022, these aren't accidents decades apart. This is a rhythm. And the Gritsiewski confrontation yesterday isn't just an awkward meeting. It's the moment where the mask slipped on camera and you could see the institutional failure in a single human face.
Let's sit with what actually happened in that room. Ilana Gritsiewski was taken from the Nova Music Festival on October 7, 2023. She was held in Gaza. She has described being physically assaulted, kept in conditions of psychological torture, and experiencing a blackout during which she has no memory, and woke up partially undressed. This is a survivor of captivity describing what any reasonable person would understand as a sexual assault scenario, even if the specific acts during the blackout are unknown to her.
The person whose job it is to advocate for women in exactly this situation sat there unmoved.
This wasn't Al-Salem's first encounter with the October 7th sexual violence evidence. She has had 2.5 years to engage with the documentation. Israeli authorities compiled forensic evidence. NGOs published detailed reports. The New York Times did a major investigation. The UN itself had a team led by Pramila Patten, the Secretary General's Special Representative on Sexual Violence and Conflict, who visited Israel and concluded that there are reasonable grounds to believe sexual violence occurred on October 7th, including rape and gang rape, and that hostages taken to Gaza continued to face such violence.
Patten's report came out in March 2024. Al-Salem's response was to call for an independent investigation, as if the Patton report, the forensic evidence, the survivor testimonies, and the video footage captured by Hamas itself didn't constitute sufficient documentation.
The pattern with Al-Salem is consistent. She acknowledges violence against women in broad, abstract terms, but when it comes to Israeli women specifically, the language shifts to evasion, to demands for more process, to whataboutism. And that's before we get to the November 2025 confrontation, where she couldn't even manage a human response to a woman sitting 3 feet away.
The stone face is what sticks with me. Not because I expect UN officials to weep on camera, but because the absence of any visible response to a testimony like that is itself a kind of response. It says, "Your suffering doesn't register in my framework."
That framework is what we need to examine. Daniel's prompt isn't really asking us to litigate whether Al-Salem and Albanese are biased. That's established. The question is about institutional design. How does a system that is supposed to produce impartial human rights monitoring instead produce a conveyor belt of partisans?
Let's name the second case study explicitly. Albanese was appointed special rapporteur on the occupied Palestinian territories in 2022. Before her appointment, she had signed a petition comparing Israel to apartheid South Africa. She had tweeted that Israel's creation was a Nakba, a catastrophe. These aren't subtle policy disagreements. These are foundational statements that prejudge the entire framework within which she's supposed to be an impartial monitor.
The UN itself has had to distance itself from her statements. In 2024, after she made comments that were widely condemned as anti-Semitic, including remarks about the Jewish lobby, a UN spokesperson issued a statement saying her views did not reflect those of the organization, but she kept her job. There's no removal mechanism for bias. Once you're appointed, you serve your term unless you resign or die.
That's the part that should stop people cold. There is no removal mechanism. You can violate the code of conduct, which explicitly requires impartiality and integrity, and nothing happens. It's a document that exists to be cited, not enforced.
That brings us to the appointment process itself. This is where the institutional design question gets technical, and it's worth understanding the mechanics because they explain almost everything.
Walk me through it. How does someone become a UN Special Rapporteur?
The UN Human Rights Council has something called the Consultative Group. It's a small body, 5 member states, one from each regional group, that reviews applications, interviews candidates, and recommends a shortlist to the President of the Human Rights Council. The President makes the final appointment from that list. That's the process on paper.
On paper? That sounds like a reasonable vetting system.
In practice, the Consultative Group's deliberations are entirely closed. There are no public hearings. There's no published criteria for what constitutes a disqualifying conflict of interest. There's no mechanism for outside stakeholders, NGOs, member states, victims groups, to submit concerns about a candidate before appointment. The whole thing happens behind closed doors, and the public sees only the outcome.
If a candidate has a documented history of statements that prejudge the subject they're being asked to monitor impartially, nobody outside the room even gets to flag that before the appointment is finalized.
And the states that sit on the consultative group are, by definition, members of the Human Rights Council, which is itself a political body. The council's membership is determined by regional bloc voting. These blocs vote together on Israel-related matters with remarkable consistency.
The Israel item. Agenda Item 7 is the only permanent country-specific item on the Council's agenda.
Every other country-specific agenda item has to be renewed periodically. Item 7 is permanent. It was baked into the Council's founding in 2006, and it means that at every single session, the Council devotes time to Israel's human rights record. No other country has this status. Not North Korea, not China, not Iran, not Russia.
You have a body where the procedural deck is stacked from the start. A permanent agenda item targeting one country, regional blocs that vote in lockstep, and an appointment process that is opaque, unaccountable, and has no conflict of interest screening.
Into that structure, you insert special rapporteurs who are supposed to be independent experts. But independence requires structural insulation from political pressure, and these rapporteurs have none. They serve at the pleasure of a political body. Their reports are submitted to that body. Their mandate renewals depend on that body. The incentives are clear. If you want your mandate renewed, don't produce reports that embarrass the states that control the renewal process.
If you're a candidate for a mandate touching Israel, and you've spent years publicly condemning Israel, that's not a liability in the appointment process. It's arguably a qualification. That's the captured institution thesis in a sentence. The system isn't failing to catch bias. It's selecting for it.
Let me give you a concrete contrast. In most domestic judicial systems, judges have clear recusal obligations. The International Court of Justice has this baked into its statute. Article 17 says judges can't participate in cases where they've been involved as agents, counsel, or advocates for one of the parties. The UN's own internal justice system, the Dispute Tribunal and the Appeals Tribunal, has actual ethics procedures and recusal mechanisms.
The special procedures mandate holders, who produce reports that get cited by the ICC and the ICJ and national governments, have none of that.
The Code of Conduct says they must act with impartiality and integrity. It's a statement of aspiration. There's no enforcement body, no investigative process for complaints. No disciplinary mechanism short of the council choosing not to renew a mandate, which, for the reasons we just described, is not going to happen when the rapporteur is producing reports that align with the council's political preferences.
This is where the knock-on effect kick in. The bias doesn't just produce unfair reports about Israel. It poisons the well for the entire human rights system.
This is the Crywolf problem, and it's devastating. When every rapporteur on the Israel portfolio is seen, correctly, as having come into the job with a predetermined conclusion, their findings get dismissed by Israel's allies, including findings that might be legitimate. If a rapporteur documents a real human rights violation affecting Palestinians, and they've spent years comparing Israel to apartheid South Africa before their appointment, the response from Washington or Berlin is going to be, "Why should we trust this person's framing?"
The people who suffer from that dynamic are the very populations the rapporteurs claim to serve. If you actually care about Palestinian human rights, you should want a rapporteur whose credibility is unassailable, someone whose findings can't be dismissed as the work of a partisan.
Instead, the system produces rapporteurs whose biases are so obvious that their reports become diplomatic ammunition rather than credible documentation. One side cites them as proof, the other side dismisses them as propaganda. The truth becomes irrelevant, and the human rights mechanism becomes just another theater in a political conflict.
This isn't a new problem. John Dugard, who held the mandate before it was split into separate roles, referred to Israel's treatment of Palestinians as apartheid, and compared it to Nazi Germany. Richard Folk, who held the mandate from 2008 to 2014, had a long history of anti-Israel advocacy, and once posted a cartoon on his blog that was widely condemned as anti-Semitic. Makarem Wibisono, who briefly held the mandate after Folk, actually resigned in 2016 and cited Israel's refusal to cooperate with him, but he also acknowledged that his own bias had been an obstacle.
Wibisono's resignation is instructive. He said, and I'm paraphrasing, that he had initially been denied access to Israel and the Palestinian territories because of his previous statements. He eventually got access, but the dynamic was poisoned from the start. The bias preceded the investigation, and the investigation's credibility never recovered. So Al-Salem and Albanese aren't outliers. They're the latest installments in a franchise.
The franchise is profitable, politically speaking. The states that dominate the Human Rights Council get a permanent platform to condemn Israel. The rapporteurs get a prestigious UN title and a global megaphone. The reports get cited in ICC proceedings and UN General Assembly resolutions. The whole machinery produces a steady output of diplomatic pressure. What it doesn't produce is credible human rights monitoring.
That's the tragedy of it. The concept of a special rapporteur is actually good. The idea that the UN should have independent experts who investigate human rights issues and report back without political interference, that's a valuable function. But the design has been hollowed out by political capture.
Let's talk about what reform would actually look like. The 2020 review of special procedures by the UN Secretary General recommended stronger vetting of candidates, more transparency in the consultative group's work, and clearer criteria for disqualification.
None of those recommendations were implemented. The states that benefit from the current system, the ones that use the Israel mandate as a diplomatic weapon, have no incentive to change it. Reform proposals go to the Human Rights Council, and the Council is the very body whose political dynamics create the problem.
You have a self-perpetuating loop. The Council appoints biased rapporteurs. The rapporteurs produce reports that serve the Council's political agenda. The Council renews their mandates. Reform proposals die in committee. And the credibility of the entire human rights apparatus erodes a little more with each cycle.
Which brings us back to Ilana Gritsevsky sitting across from Reem Al-Salem, describing the worst moments of her life to a woman whose job is to care about exactly that, and getting nothing back but a stone face. That's not just a failure of one person. It's the logical endpoint of a system that was never designed to take the suffering of Israeli women seriously.
The question Daniel's asking is whether this can be fixed from within, or whether the structural bias requires building something parallel. Alternative institutions, independent monitoring bodies, mechanisms that don't depend on a captured council for their legitimacy.
That's the question we're going to dig into. But first, let's get under the hood of how these appointments actually work. The consultative group, the regional block dynamics, the permanent agenda item 7, because you can't understand the pattern without understanding the machine that produces it. If we're asking whether this is about two bad hires or a broken hiring machine, the answer is already visible in the timeline. Al-Salem in 2020, Albanese in 2022, two consecutive mandates touching Israel, both filled by people whose pre-appointment record should have raised flags in any functioning vetting system.
The fact that it didn't raise flags tells you something about what the system is actually selecting for.
Let's be precise about what these two cases look like side by side. Al-Salem's mandate covers all women, everywhere. But when the largest single incident of mass sexual violence against Jewish women since the Holocaust occurs, her response pattern is consistent. Delay, demand more investigation, refuse to name Hamas, refuse to acknowledge the forensic evidence. And then, when confronted directly by a survivor, she can't even offer a human reaction.
Albanese's mandate is narrower, explicitly about Israel's conduct. But the question isn't whether she has opinions. It's whether she came into the role having already reached conclusions that make impartial monitoring impossible. The apartheid petition, the Nakba framing, the Jewish lobby comments. These aren't policy critiques. They're identity-level statements about the legitimacy of the state she's supposed to monitor.
Both of these women had public records before their appointments. Al-Salem's social media history included statements about Israel that human rights groups had flagged. Albanese's was even more extensive. The consultative group either didn't look at these records, or looked at them and didn't consider them disqualifying. Either way, the vetting process failed.
The stakes are high. These aren't academic appointments. Special rapporteurs produce reports that get cited in international criminal court investigations, in international court of justice proceedings, in UN Security Council briefings. When the ICC prosecutor decides whether to open an investigation, she cites special rapporteur reports as evidence of the gravity and scale of alleged crimes.
National governments use these reports too. Foreign ministries cite them when imposing sanctions. Parliamentarians cite them in debates about arms sales. Media organizations report their findings as authoritative UN conclusions. The imprimatur of the UN carries weight, and these rapporteurs are the ones stamping it onto documents that shape international law and diplomacy.
When a rapporteur comes into the role with a baked-in conclusion about Israel, that conclusion doesn't stay in Geneva. It becomes part of the evidentiary record in legal proceedings. It shapes the discourse in capitals. It influences which cases get pursued and which get ignored.
The inverse is true, too. When these rapporteurs are seen as compromised, their findings on Palestinian rights, even findings that might be entirely legitimate, get dismissed by the very governments whose attention Palestinian human rights advocates need. The bias doesn't just hurt Israel. It hurts the credibility of Palestinian human rights claims.
That's the paradox at the center of this. If you genuinely care about Palestinian human rights, the worst thing you can do is install a rapporteur whose impartiality is compromised from day one. You're guaranteeing that half the world will tune out whatever they say.
The question Daniel's really asking, is this about individuals or the system, answers itself once you look at the institutional incentives. The system isn't failing to catch biased rapporteurs. It's built to produce them. Let's walk through the appointment machine itself, because the mechanics are where the design intent becomes visible. The consultative group is 5 member states, 1 from each UN regional group. They review applications, interview candidates, recommend a shortlist to the president of the Human Rights Council. The president picks from that list. That's the entire process.
5 people in a room, no transcript, no public record of what was discussed.
No published criteria for what constitutes a disqualifying conflict of interest. The code of conduct says mandate holders must act with impartiality and integrity, but there's no mechanism to assess that before appointment. No ethics review. No background check that examines a candidate's public statements on the subject they're being asked to monitor.
If you're a candidate for the Violence Against Women mandate, and you've spent years making statements about Israel that suggest you don't consider Israeli women's suffering to be within your frame of concern, nobody in that room is required to flag it. And nobody outside the room even knows to raise the alarm. The first time the public sees anything is when the appointment is announced.
Contrast that with how judicial appointments work in any functioning legal system. In the United States, federal judges go through Senate confirmation hearings where their prior rulings, writings, and public statements are all fair game. At the ICJ, judges are elected by the General Assembly and Security Council, and Article 17 of the ICJ statute explicitly bars them from sitting on cases where they've previously been involved as advocates. The UN special procedures have the Code of Conduct, which uses similar language: impartiality, integrity, but it's entirely aspirational. There's no enforcement body, no investigative process for complaints, no disciplinary mechanism.
You've got a system where the vetting is opaque, the standards are unenforceable, and the decision-makers are political actors representing regional blocs that vote in lockstep on Israel-related matters. And into that system, you feed candidates whose pre-appointment record on Israel is a matter of public record.
Take Albanese specifically. Before her 2022 appointment, she had signed a petition describing Israel as an apartheid state and calling for a military embargo. She had tweeted that Israel's founding was a Nakba, a statement about the legitimacy of the state's existence. She had made comments about the Jewish lobby controlling American foreign policy. Any one of these should have triggered a conflict of interest review in a functioning system.
The UN itself later distanced itself from the Jewish lobby comments. A UN spokesperson put out a statement in 2024 saying her views didn't reflect the organization, but she kept her job. Because there's no removal mechanism.
That's the structural void at the center of this. The code of conduct exists. It says the right things. But it has no teeth. A mandate holder can violate every principle in that document, and the only consequence available is that the council might choose not to renew their mandate when it expires. And a rapporteur who produces reports aligning with the council's preferences on Israel is not going to face non-renewal.
The incentives run the other direction. If you're a candidate for a mandate touching Israel, your pre-existing anti-Israel advocacy is functionally a credential. It signals to the consultative group that you'll produce the kind of reports the council wants. And if you're already in the role, the same logic applies. Produce reports that fit the political agenda, and you get another term.
Al-Salem's case illustrates this from a slightly different angle. Her mandate is violence against women. It's not Israel-specific. But the political dynamics around Israel are so pervasive in the council that even a mandate with global scope gets pulled into the gravity well. The October 7th attacks produced the most extensively documented incident of mass sexual violence in a single day in recent memory, and the Special Rapporteur on Violence Against Women responded by calling for more investigation. For 2.5 years. While Pramila Patten's team, her own UN colleague, concluded there were reasonable grounds to believe sexual violence occurred.
That posture is consistent with what you'd expect from someone whose pre-appointment worldview didn't include Israeli women as victims worthy of her advocacy. The bias isn't a departure from her mandate. It's baked into how she understands the mandate's scope.
The November 2025 confrontation with Ilana Grudziewski crystallized this. Here was a survivor, in person, describing an experience that any reasonable person would understand as sexual violence. Blacking out, waking up half naked, no memory of what was done to her body. And Al-Salem couldn't bring herself to offer even the most basic human acknowledgement. Not because she's incapable of empathy, because acknowledging Grudziewski's suffering would require acknowledging that Israeli women are within her frame of concern. And that acknowledgement would contradict the political framework that made her appointment possible in the first place.
The stone face wasn't a personal failure. It was an institutional product.
That's what makes this different from a normal hiring mistake. In a well-functioning organization, if you accidentally hire someone with a conflict of interest, you have mechanisms to catch it, correct it, and prevent it from happening again. The UN Human Rights Council has none of those mechanisms, not by accident.
The 2020 review of special procedures by the Secretary General recommended stronger vetting, more transparency in the consultative group, clearer disqualification criteria. None of it was implemented. The states that benefit from the current system blocked reform, and they'll keep blocking it because the system is working exactly as they intend it to.
Which means the question isn't whether the UN can fix this. The question is whether the UN, as currently constituted, wants to. The appointment process is broken, but the consequences go much deeper than just bad appointments. The real damage is what this does to the credibility of the entire UN human rights apparatus.
The Crywolf problem.
When every rapporteur touching the Israel portfolio comes into the job with a documented history of anti-Israel advocacy, their findings, even findings that might be entirely legitimate, get dismissed by Israel's allies. If a rapporteur documents a real human rights violation affecting Palestinians, and that rapporteur spent years before their appointment comparing Israel to apartheid South Africa, the response from Washington or Berlin is predictable. Why should we trust this person's framing?
That's not a hypothetical. It's the actual dynamic that plays out every time one of these reports drops. The U.S. State Department issues a statement questioning the rapporteur's impartiality. Israel refuses to cooperate. The report becomes diplomatic ammunition rather than credible documentation. One side cites it as proof, the other dismisses it as propaganda, and the truth gets lost in the middle.
The people who suffer are the very populations the rapporteurs claim to serve. If you care about Palestinian human rights, you should want a rapporteur whose credibility is unassailable. Instead, the system produces the opposite, rapporteurs whose biases are so obvious that their reports become just another theater in a political conflict.
It's a self-defeating arrangement if your goal is actually improving human rights, but it's perfectly functional if your goal is producing diplomatic pressure against Israel.
That brings us to the structural engine that drives all of this, the regional bloc voting system and Agenda Item 7, the only permanent country-specific item on the Council's agenda.
Every other country-specific agenda item has to be renewed periodically. Syria, North Korea, Myanmar, each comes up for renewal, and the Council has to vote to keep them on the agenda. Item 7 is permanent. It was baked into the Council's founding resolution in 2006, and it means that at every single session, the Council devotes dedicated time to Israel's human rights record. No other country has this status.
The permanent nature of Item 7 creates a structural demand. The Council needs content for that agenda slot. It needs reports, findings, documentation. It needs rapporteurs who will produce material that justifies the permanent agenda item's existence. So the appointment process isn't just passively failing to screen for bias. It's actively selecting for candidates who will fulfill the political function. The agenda item was designed to serve.
The agenda item creates the job. The job requires a certain kind of output. The appointment process selects for candidates who will produce that output. It's a closed loop.
The regional bloc dynamic reinforces it. The Africa group and the Asia Pacific group together control a majority of council seats. Many of their member states have their own reasons for wanting Israel to remain the council's primary focus. It deflects attention from their own human rights records. It aligns with OIC and Arab League positions, and it provides a reliable source of diplomatic solidarity within the bloc. Voting against Israel-related resolutions is politically costly within these groups. Voting for them costs nothing.
You've got a permanent agenda item targeting one country, a voting structure that makes criticism of that country politically profitable, and an appointment process that is opaque and unaccountable. The bias in the rapporteurs isn't a bug. It's what the system is designed to produce.
This is where the captured institution thesis becomes hard to avoid. The UN Human Rights Council was created in 2006 to replace the Commission on Human Rights, which had been discredited partly because of its selective targeting of Israel. The new council was supposed to fix that problem. Instead, it institutionalized it. The permanent Agenda Item 7 was carried over. The regional bloc dynamics were preserved. And the appointment process for special procedures was given no meaningful reform.
The institution was captured from the start. The states that wanted a permanent platform for condemning Israel got exactly that, wrapped in the language of human rights.
The reform proposals exist. The 2020 UN Secretary General's review recommended mandatory conflict of interest screening before appointment, public hearings for candidates, a removal mechanism for demonstrated bias, and term limits to prevent entrenchment. None of it was implemented.
Here's the reform paradox. The very states that benefit from the current system are the ones who would have to vote to change it. The Human Rights Council would have to vote to reform its own appointment process. The states that use the Israel mandate as a diplomatic weapon would have to voluntarily disarm. That's not going to happen.
There's an irony worth naming. The UN actually has functioning ethics and recusal mechanisms in other parts of its system. The UN Dispute Tribunal and the UN Appeals Tribunal have actual recusal procedures. Judges have to disclose conflicts. Parties can file motions for disqualification. The UN knows how to build these systems. It just hasn't applied that knowledge to the special procedures.
Because applying it to the special procedures would interfere with their political function.
That political function has real-world legal consequences now that the ICC and ICJ increasingly cite special rapporteur reports in their proceedings. When the ICC prosecutor weighs whether to open an investigation, she looks at the gravity and scale of alleged crimes. Special rapporteur reports are part of that assessment. So the bias that enters the system at the appointment stage doesn't stay in Geneva. It travels into courtrooms in The Hague. It shapes who gets investigated and who doesn't.
Which means the credibility crisis isn't just a reputational problem for the UN. It's a due process problem for the entire international legal system. When a court relies on findings produced by a rapporteur who was selected for their political alignment rather than their impartiality, the court's own legitimacy takes a hit.
That's the knock-on effect that should worry everyone, regardless of what you think about Israel. If the UN human rights system becomes so politicized that its findings can't be trusted, the entire project of international human rights law loses its foundation. You can't build credible legal institutions on top of a political machinery that selects for bias.
The Grudzowski moment, the stone face, the refusal to acknowledge, that's what the end of that road looks like. A survivor of mass sexual violence sits across from the UN's designated advocate for women like her, and the advocate can't bring herself to care. Not because she's a bad person, because caring would contradict the institutional logic that put her in that chair. Where does that leave someone watching this from the outside? Daniel's watching the Grudzowski footage, seeing the stone face, and asking what can actually be done. Let's get practical.
First thing, when you see a UN Special Rapporteur's report cited in news coverage, look up the mandate holder, not the report. Their pre-appointment statements are almost always public, their social media history, their organizational affiliations. The news story will say, UN expert says X, and leave it at that. But the information about whether that expert came into the role with a documented bias is usually a search away.
That context changes how you read the report. If the rapporteur on the occupied Palestinian territories was comparing Israel to apartheid South Africa before she got the job, you know something about the lens she's using. That doesn't mean everything in the report is false. It means you read it the way you'd read a prosecutor's brief. Useful data, but not neutral.
The reform agenda, if we're being concrete, has four pieces. 1. Mandatory conflict of interest screening before appointment. 2. Public hearings for candidates. Put them in a room, let NGOs and member states ask questions about their prior statements, and make the transcript public. 3. A removal mechanism for demonstrated bias. If a mandate holder violates the Code of Conduct's impartiality requirement, there needs to be a process. Complaints, investigation, consequences. 4. Term limits. One mandate, one term, no renewal. You remove the incentive to produce politically convenient reports to secure reappointment.
On the listener's side, there are organizations that track this systematically. UN Watch, Hillel Noyer's work, they document special procedures, bias, they submit evidence to the council, they publish analysis that connects the dots between a rapporteur's pre-appointment record and their subsequent reports. Supporting that work is one lever. Another is contacting your government's UN mission and asking them directly what they're doing to push for consultative group reform.
Most people don't realize their country has a UN mission they can write to. But those missions vote on Human Rights Council resolutions. They participate in the diplomatic processes that shape these appointments. A constituent email asking about conflict of interest screening for special rapporteurs isn't going to change the system overnight, but enough of them changes the political calculus for the diplomats whose job is to care what citizens back home think.
The practical toolkit is straightforward. Vet the rapporteur before you trust the report. Support the watchdogs doing the tracking. Make noise with your government's UN mission. None of it is complicated. It just requires knowing that the machinery exists and that the bias isn't accidental.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In 1917, the Italian colony of Eritrea experienced a series of volcanic eruptions from Mount Alid that released unusually high concentrations of hydrogen fluoride gas. The fluorine settled on grazing lands and was ingested by livestock, causing a wave of dental fluorosis across the region's goat and cattle populations, teeth blackened and crumbled. Colonial authorities initially suspected deliberate poisoning by local resistance groups and launched a criminal investigation before geologists identified the volcanic source.
The Italians thought the goats were being poisoned by insurgents.
dental fluorosis as a counterinsurgency false flag. That's a first. Even with those practical steps, there's a deeper question the system hasn't answered. Can this actually be reformed from within, or does the structural bias require building something parallel?
That's the fork in the road. Reform from within means persuading the very states that benefit from the current arrangement to vote against their own interests. The 2020 recommendations died because the council's political composition made them dead on arrival. There's no reason to think a new reform push would fare differently, unless the membership changes, and the regional blocs that control the membership have no incentive to change.
The alternative is parallel institutions. Independent monitoring bodies that don't depend on the Human Rights Council for their legitimacy. Something with its own funding, its own appointment procedures, its own ethics mechanisms, structurally insulated from the General Assembly and the Council.
The problem with parallel institutions is that they take decades to build, and in the meantime, the existing machinery keeps grinding. Every year, the Council operates as it does. Another batch of reports enters the evidentiary record. Another round of ICC citations. Another cycle of diplomatic pressure built on findings that were compromised before the investigation even started.
This is where the legal consequences stop being abstract. When the ICJ issued its advisory opinion on the legality of the Israeli occupation, it cited multiple special procedure mandate holders. When the ICC prosecutor assesses the gravity of alleged crimes, those reports are part of the dossier. The bias that enters at the appointment stage travels all the way into courtrooms where actual legal determinations are being made.
The institutional failure isn't just a political problem. It's becoming a due process problem in international law. If a court relies on findings produced by a rapporteur who is selected for political alignment rather than impartiality, the court's own legitimacy is compromised. And that legitimacy is already fragile enough.
Which brings us back to Ilana Gradzowski. Because at the end of all the institutional analysis, all the procedural mechanics, all the reform proposals, there's a woman who sat in a room and described the worst experience of her life to the person the world appointed to care about exactly that, and got nothing back.
The stone face is what the system produced. Not a bad day for one rapporteur. Not a personal failing. The logical endpoint of a machine that was built to treat Israeli women's suffering as outside the frame. Gradzowski's testimony didn't fail to move Absalom. It was never going to move her. That was decided long before she walked into the room. Decided in the appointment process, in the regional block dynamics, in the permanent agenda item 7, in every structural choice that put someone in that chair, whose framework had no room for what she was being asked to see.
That's the human cost of institutional failure, not an awkward diplomatic incident. A survivor of mass sexual violence, looking for acknowledgement from the global system that claims to exist for people like her, and finding that the system was never designed to see her at all.
The question Daniels left us with is whether that system can be rebuilt from the inside, or whether the people who need it to work have to start building something else. I don't think there's a comfortable answer. But the Gradzowski footage made the cost of not answering it impossible to ignore.
This has been My Weird Props. Thanks to our producer Hilbert Flumingtop for keeping the whole operation running.
If you want to dig deeper into any of the cases or reform proposals we discussed today, the show notes are up at myweirdprompts.com. And if this episode gave you something to think about, leave us a review wherever you listen. It actually helps more people find the show.
We'll be back next week.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Props, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. stay curious, keep weird in mind.